Good morning.
Good morning. This week, we begin in our liturgical cycle of Torah readings, we begin the story of Joseph. Yosef. It's a familiar story, and yet reading it closely, one does pick up a number of themes that aren't necessarily always talked about, but I did find some sources for it. And that's basically the theme that I like to deal today is from narcissism to empathy in the Joseph story. Because quite clearly, being the son of Jacob, he has a certain kind of arrogance that we saw in the beginning when Joseph got up from his dream, if you remember in Bethel, and has this kind of chutzpahdika approach to God and say, well, if you do everything for me, you'll be my God. It's sort of juvenile approach to it. And of course, the story begins with his seeming to be made a favorite. And many people say that one of the steps towards narcissistic, or if you will, self-centeredness, is adoration by parents. That's one factor that often comes in, where the child is told that he or she is very special, that they can really do no wrong, that they are loved more than other siblings of the family. And we know from our own political revelations of the last 7 years that narcissism can be very destructive and can lead to a certain sociopathic nature as well, but not necessarily. So the story of Joseph evolves by seeing him change. He's 17 when he leaves home. He spends a few years in the household of Potiphar. He's put into prison. He's taken out of prison, and you know the story of him becoming the viceroy of Egypt with great power. And of course, this enhances his sense of self, if you will. Rather than self-confidence, he becomes a bit. We see by the end of the story a bit tyrannical himself. So I won't get into all the details of that. I just wanted to talk about this transformation. Now, when looking for, because we always in our tradition here at TBC, I'm a shtickl jubu, a little jubu a little bit. So we like to go to Buddhist sources as well. But that leads to kind of really, really interesting and complicated questions about self. And it seems that one of the things that really we do not share necessarily, maybe in the long run we share it because everybody's going to the same place ultimately, I hope, which is basically to create a world where we are filled with empathy. But there is this issue of self. Is there a self? And if there's no self, then maybe there's no narcissism in Buddhism. But of course, there is. People do have to overcome certain senses of their own importance and their own, this anthropocentric view of the world that we have. And they offer a number of suggestions. And they say that, one of the things that you should strive for, I found two wonderful quotes, which might be helpful to us. One is from Trungpa, Hayim Trungpa. He has a book, as you may know. Trungpa is of a Tibetan Buddhist tradition. He was called a mad or crazy wisdom teacher for all kinds of reasons, because he sort of, in his own behavior, is often went, challenged, if you will, the orthodoxies. He became important. He started the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, which is the only university under Buddhist auspices in the United States. So it's important to see, he says, that the main point of any spiritual practice is to step out of the bureaucracy of ego. It's a wonderful term. Trungpa, in his book, means stepping out of ego's constant desire for a higher, more spiritual, more transcendental version of knowledge, religion, virtue, judgment, comfort, or whatever it is the particular ego is seeking. So even in our practice, we somehow want to, if you will, enhance ourselves by seeing how well we do, quote unquote, in our practice. Another scholar, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, says the importance of a healthy ego for a good life cannot be overestimated, because it says if the ego functions are healthy and well-coordinated, they give you a consistent sense of priorities as to which forms of happiness are more worthwhile than others, a clear sense of where your responsibilities do and don't lie, a strong sense of your ability to judge right and wrong for yourself, and an honest sense of how to learn from your past mistakes for the sake of greater happiness in the future. Another writer says that the Buddha taught that to realize enlightenment, a person must develop two qualities, wisdom and compassion. Wisdom and compassion are sometimes compared to two wings that work together to enable flying, or two eyes that work together to see more deeply. In the West, we're taught to think of wisdom as something that is primarily intellectual, and quote-unquote compassion as something that is primarily emotional, and that these two things are separate and even incompatible. And we're led to believe that fuzzy, sappy emotion gets in the way of clear, logical, if you will, wisdom. But the Buddhists, according to this writer, Barbara O'Brien, do not understand it this way. And they talk about the fact that the Sanskrit word, usually translated as wisdom, prana, or pana, which can be translated as consciousness or discernment or insight, each of the many schools of Buddhism understand prajna somehow differently, but generally we can say that prajna is understanding or discernment of the Buddha's teaching, especially of the teaching of anatta, anatta, which means the principle of no self. So these things are the word usually translated as compassion is karuna, which is understood to mean active sympathy or a willingness to bear the pain of others. In practice, prajna gives rise to karuna, and karuna gives rise to prajna. Truly, you can't have one without the other. And they are means of realizing enlightenment and in themselves, they're also enlightenment itself manifested. Just one or two more things. The Dalai Lama, in a wonderful book called The Essence of the Heart Sutra, he says, according to Buddhism, compassion is an aspiration, a state of mind, wanting others to be free from suffering. It's not passive. It's not empathy alone, but rather the empathetic altruism that actively strives to free others from suffering. General compassion must have both wisdom and loving kindness, as we said earlier. And that is to say, one must understand the nature of the suffering from which we wish to free others. This is wisdom. And one must experience deep intimacy and empathy with other sentient beings. This is loving kindness. And there are certain wholesome and positive virtues, he says, inherent in the human mind, which can give rise to positive emotional health, happiness, rewarding social relationships, and contribute to the spiritual development when they are developed and maintained. Lord Gautama Buddha called them Brahma Viharas. Brahma Viharas, V-I-H-A-R-A-S, which means dwelling places of Brahma. Brahma is a form of celestial beings existing in the heavenly worlds. And just to remind people who have not been familiar with this, there are four Brahma Viharas. The first one we know quite a bit about, and that's loving kindness, metta. And then there is compassion, karuna. Then there's sympathetic joy, mudita. And then equanimity, upekkha. Upekkha, U-P-E-K-K-H-A. And these are known as the abodes of Brahma, excellent or sublime attitudes, boundless states, divine states, and the immeasurables. These things cannot be immeasurable. You can't overdose, it seems, on empathy and on metta and karuna. They are referred to as abodes of Brahma, as the Brahmas are supposed to possess limitless loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity towards other beings. So the Buddhist state of affairs, they understand that even though we may not have a self that is necessarily narcissistic, we do have, and of course this is a very primary subject we deal with all the time in our practice, and that is the issue of ego. And of course, as you know, ego has its pluses and its minuses. In the Jewish tradition, ego is so associated perhaps with Yetzer Hara, or the sort of the negative or evil inclination, and yet it ties itself with Yetzer HaTov. Yetzer HaTov, the positive inclinations we have towards goodness, and those that we might have towards less skillful associations, they're two sides of a one coin, and one needs the ego often to establish oneself in the real world, in what we do, what we build, because if we had been only left with Yetzer HaTov, it might lead to a certain kind of passivity, if you will, allow me that word. And empathy is an essential skill for our personal, social, and religious development. And we generally associate empathy with the ability to feel sorry when someone else is struggling, but this is only one side of empathy. It's referred to by some as the emotional or affective empathy. And a second type of empathy is called cognitive empathy, which is the ability to intellectually understand the perspective of other people, identifying what they may be feeling, why they may be feeling that way, and how their behavior connects to what they are feeling. Someone who has cognitive empathy for another person may not feel emotional about the other's plight, but will intellectually understand it better. What experiencing, and this is, we find this in many of the Jewish sources, experiencing either of these types of empathy, which is basically intellectual or cognitive, is not inherently beneficial to others. Some people who feel intense emotional empathy for another may be too overwhelmed by their own negative feelings that they are unable to help. And just understanding intellectually that someone is going through also does not necessarily lead to helping behaviors. In fact, sociopaths often score high on scales of cognitive empathy, but they understand what people are feeling very well. And then they can then use that knowledge to hurt and manipulate people. Developing cognitive and emotional empathy are morally and socially important, but only when they lead to the service of others. When the empathy leads to helping, it is referred to, as we saw in our Buddhist sources as well, compassionate empathy. Of course, this idea that sociopaths can use this emotional empathy, we have seen all too often by creating a sense of grievance and a sense of victimhood, which is often characteristics, if you will, of cognitive disorder, which has been part of the psychiatry handbook for a very long time. So one rabbi I found gives a lovely little example of this. So again, he says, empathy is the action of being aware, being sensitive to, and vicariously understanding, experiencing the thoughts and feelings of another while sensing their deepest inner emotions. Empathy is being able to put ourselves, as we often say, in another person's shoes. It emerges in a situation where I and you becomes I am you, or I might be you. So true empathy exists when we feel sad because the people around us feel sad, when we are upset to see something being treated disrespectfully, when we are in tune with other people's moods, when we look at every side of an argument before we make a decision, when we get a strong urge to help after coming across someone who is upset, when we see someone being taken advantage of and feel protective of them, when we truly enjoy making other people feel better. The story is told about Rabbi Shmuel of Lubavitch, who often spent hours receiving visitors in private. And during that time, he would perspire profusely and on occasion even excused himself in the middle of the interview to change his clothes. When asked for the reason, he said, when I receive a visitor, I am wearing my own garments. But to understand his comments from his perspective, I must remove my garments and don his. At this point, I must consider the problem from my own perspective, and for that, I must put on my garments again. Having developed a suitable response, I must dress my advice in words suitable to my visitor's ears, and for that, I must once again put on his garments. Knowing this, are you surprised that I perspire? And this would be seen as authentic empathy. So it can be overwhelming at times, empathy. It can be demanding of times. It is certainly a gift, if you will, that keeps on giving and inspires us, I believe. I hope it inspires us to the idea that action is very much more efficacious, if you will, more efficacious than non-action. So you see, this is all very confused. The Joseph story is a fascinating one because even throughout the story, he will refer occasionally to God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh-Heh, but it's even there, it can be seen, if you will, as a certain manipulation to give him a sense of power. For instance, in the interpretation of the dreams that Pharaoh has and is being brought out of prison in order to do so, we begin to see Joseph using this idea and explaining what is the process that's going to take place of starvation and bounty. And then he very cleverly puts himself in the situation where he sort of infers that Pharaoh, you know, this is going to be a very tough task, and I certainly know what it's going to take to do it well, basically proposing himself to do it. And that that hint is taken on, and indeed, Joseph is appointed the one who will deal with, if you will, the economy of Egypt for years to come. So, even the referring to God can be a tool for maintaining a narcissistic position, or if you will, or a self-centered position. And this goes on through, because ultimately what happened in the Joseph story, I don't want to give away the ending, but many of you know, will again ascend to a position of great authority. And in that sense of great authority, the question is, can he maintain a certain level of empathy? And can he do something about it? And he certainly tries with the storing of the grain, of course, and trying to prevent that starvation. And then finally, though, at the end of the story, we do see that he somehow is able to maintain a certain kind of empathy even for those who made him suffer his brothers. And even, it's couched even that enmity, because ultimately Joseph is such a strongly, quote-unquote, narcissistic personality that even there he tries to, in a sense, create a tension that the brothers are always fearful that he might basically lash out against them in a sense of revenge and take away their independence, either by imprisoning them or even more harshly, perhaps by killing them. So I would like to propose that we basically are able in our practice to... And particularly as Jews, I must say, because it's very hard for me still to understand the no-selfness. I understand that in our traditions, we are different in the sense we don't want to disappear. We don't want to take, you know, we don't want to give up our ego totally and give up. I think in the sense that we become, if you will, somebody or something. We don't know how to use the word even, that somehow we get overcome and swallowed up. In our tradition, at best, we believe that one can cling, if you will, or cleave onto what we call the Godhead, but one cannot be, one should not be absorbed into it. So, as I say, we will spend some time down the road talking a bit about self and no self, but I admit that to me it's not easy to grasp, and we will hopefully figure it out a little bit better as we move on. So finally, and this is where I invite you for your comments and discussion, and is what are we by necessity have to be a bit narcissistic in order to basically build up our self-identity? What becomes dangerous, of course, is that we don't see narcissism as a springboard for the next step, which is trying to become empathic. And this empathy, as one of the rabbis I read said, is indeed a gift. It's a gift. It's the possibility of maintaining, if you will, your sense of self, but only in relation to the capacity to see what has to change, what has to be improved, what kind of action can we take in the world. And I know some of the times people, I wouldn't say land-based, but people criticize if you were sitting in silence and saying, oh, you're trying to encourage a sense of passivity. And of course, we know through many, many teachers that this is not the case at all. That by sitting still and being in the moment, we begin to realize how much in the moment still there's things that ought to be a certain way that are not necessarily here right now. So I'm eager to hear what you have to say about this path that we take and the goal that we have to be able to become empathic, to become compassionate, and to understand very well that it is in the actions that where compassion and empathy are indeed exhibited. Thank you for paying attention to my long-winded talk.